talk, we have got get rich and live up to the fullness and have things that flourish. Right now, my full stress, cause this was not a decision. Still hold my opinion. That's not where you belong. God alone can prove me wrong. This was not a decision.
KUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune into the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, and every second Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison at ckut.ca.
Yes, rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
You were a number, you weren't a name, you want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
Good evening and welcome to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Virginia and I'll be your host for today. We have a long interview for you today with Margaret Schiller. Schiller's book, Remembering the Armed Struggle, has recently been released in English by Montreal-based publisher Chris Blebedeb. Schiller joined two revolutionary organizations as a young person in 1970s Germany. She was a part of the Socialist Patients Collective and then joined the Armed Struggle group founded by Andreas Bader and Ulrike Meinhof and others, which was called the Red Army Faction, otherwise known as the RAF. Schiller's time in the underground was cut short after a few months when she was picked up on the street and identified by police as part of the group. She spent 17 months in prison before being released. Almost immediately after being released, Schiller rejoined the underground and became part of the reconstituted RAF, as all of the founders of the organization were now in prison. She spent 9 months underground before being arrested again. Her final stint in prison lasted from February 1974 until her release in 1979. You can find copies of her book online at leftwingbooks.net. Without further ado, here's our interview with Margaret Schiller.
I was born very short after the Second World War in Germany. I was born in 48, and it's normally for people here something that they can't imagine. Second World War, it's centuries ago. No, I was born directly after that, and with all the consequences. It marked me. I return to that later. In the 60s, I slowly became aware of where I lived. And in the 70s, I joined the armed struggle, but after a very short time, I yet was in prison. And I stayed 7 years in prison. In 85, I left Europe to get exile first at Cuba, 8 years, and then in another country in the south of Latin America, Uruguay, for another 10 years. In these years, there were born my twins, They have now 32 years. They are so half Cubans, half German. And I returned to Germany in 2003. I returned because of economic necessities. I was no longer a political refugee as I went to Cuba. I returned as an economic refugee because I couldn't earn no money anymore for my children and me. Since 2003, I live in Germany.
And your book is mostly about your period in the armed struggle. And we are mostly going to be talking about that and mostly going to be talking about your time in prison. And you were a part of an organization called the Red Army Faction, which is what ended up leading to you spending time in prison. I know listeners of our show will maybe have heard of the Red Army Faction before. We have had someone on who talked a lot about the history of the group, but it's been a few years now. And so I'm curious if you could describe what the RAF was for listeners who might not be familiar with that organization.
Yeah, they existed at the beginning of the 70s. Three different groups that made armed struggle. And one of them was the RAF, where I joined. I think in many ways it's very important always to refer to history. It was an historical situation worldwide where in many continents of the world there emerged armed struggle. Or before yet, in the 50s, in Africa, and Asia, in the 70s, in Latin America, and many other countries and continents, there emerged armed struggles. So in Germany too, RAF was one of the three, as I told you yet, and they made a lot of strong attacks. We defined ourselves, we saw ourselves as part of the anti-imperialistic fight worldwide. And this internationalistic vision was one of the two strong bases of our fight. We saw us as fighting together with Tupamaros, with Black Panther, with especially at the first time against war in Vietnam, but really to fight for liberation in the world. I see people today, and when I read my book, and they say, "Oh, how I can't imagine now how it was at that time." But when I speak with people in Latin America of my age, or 10, 15 years younger, they say, "Oh yes, I felt the same. I heard the same music and I had the same ideas." And really it was something that was in many parts of the world. In Germany, the other part of the basis was the fight against fascism. You know, there had been till 45 in Germany Hitler and fascism, but it didn't finish in 45. The mind of fascist people was continuing in a very generalized way. There was a very strong authoritarianism, and my father's, the university in school, in the street, this kind of thinking, someone is commanding and the others are saying, "Yes, I do," and pulling down the head. We really wanted to finish that. And that was something for me personally, to something very profound, very deep. I don't want this kind of being, living, thinking now. And I think every person has the responsibility for what had happened. And in Germany, with this kind of authoritarianism, everyone neglected responsibility of what had happened against Jewish people in the time of Hitler.
So we have had a few people on our show before who have either made the choice to join the armed struggle or to go underground and support the armed struggle. We've talked to, as you mentioned, people from the Black Panther Party, but also Anne Hansen, who wrote the introduction to the English translation of your book, and Diana Block, who's another woman who spent time underground in the 90s and who all were operating, I think, in a time period, as you say, where lots of people were making that choice. In the book, you talk about how you potentially decided to join an organization like the RAF in a different way than other people you knew. And you write, "I joined the RAF without having spent years studying the theory of revolution, yet I did not take this path by chance. There was and still is a continuous thread running through my life that started back then." And I think a lot of people assume that revolutionaries fight on the strength of their knowledge and their understanding and their analysis. But your book lays out a path to revolutionary struggle that is different from that. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit more about that path and how that path was different from other people around you at the time.
Look, the vision of things is so always something different than the facts. What other people think or what is shown as... Look, I was not so different. Of course, I was no founder of the guerrilla. I was no leader of the guerrilla. I wanted, that is clear. I fought, I tried to fight. It was a very short time I could, then they took me prisoner. And, but for me, I wrote this in the book because in Germany, obviously in other countries too, there is the pretension that you have to know everything before you can act. And I want to say, no, it doesn't function like that. And really nowhere. Of course, the people who were the founders of the guerrilla had made much more experiences, political experiences, had read much more than me. And when you try to found something that is very exceptional in the country, in the area where you move, you have really to reflect a lot how to make it. And of course, I always reflected what I did, but the strongest impulse I had was my feelings and my relationship with the country and what happened, what I could perceive in the world without knowing everything. I really had a long time the idea that I made something wrong because I didn't read so much before, and that was a judgment that many leftist people in Germany are doing. You have to read and to read and to read before you act. Shit, I say, shit. But I really understood that's not the way it works. When I was in Latin America, in Uruguay, there had been a lot of people, Utupamaros, in the fight against the system in Uruguay in that time. And when I was in Uruguay, I got to know many people who had been in prison, in exile, in the 60s and the 70s. And I was there in the 19th. And I spoke to them about that feeling that I feel it's rare how I participated and why I participate. And they laughed and said, the big majority of us joined like you. You have to look how you get together, your feeling and your thinking. But the deep feeling of to want to fight against injustice is really something that leads you. And I think it leads me till today. And I think it's a strength of mine that I rely on my feelings. And of course, I rely on my head too. But it's clear that I'm not a theoretical person. I never was. I read a lot of books, but I'm not a person who at first tries to be an analyst. No, I try to bring them together, my feeling and my intuition and what I see in the world and how I analyze it.
I want to talk a little bit more about the Red Army faction and the kinds of actions that were happening. As you write in the book, you were involved in the Red Army faction for a very short period of time on the outside, before you went to prison, and, you know, then a little bit more time on the outside, and then you went back to prison again. But you have a few different times in the book you reflect on the different kinds of actions that the RAF carried out, including actions that were carried out while you were in prison. And you talk about this dynamic that I think isn't as much of a debate anymore, possibly because people of my generation and maybe the generation a bit older than me decided that armed struggle didn't make sense, or, you know, just haven't engaged with that debate in a long time in a very serious way, I don't think. Anyway, I'm curious if you can talk about the choices that you guys were making about who to target in the armed struggle and changes that you had in terms of your thinking around that, specifically in terms of bystanders. Yeah, I'm curious if you can talk more about how your thinking changed around bystanders, around people who were not specifically the target of an action but ended up in the crossfire of an action, and how that changing of your mind or rethinking about those kinds of things happened for you.
You put two things together that for me doesn't belong together. I think, personally, I think, and it's objectively, you can see it, it's not the time for armed struggle in the last years, in the last 20 years, something like that. There was no one, and if there is no one, it's I'm convinced it's always an expression of an historical situation. There is no possibility to fight. There's no way to do it. And especially after 90, I say the change of the world, the finishing of the two power world, we say, there's one side US and the other side L'Union Sovietica, Soviet Union, and Soviet Union finished in 90. And that was such a big confusion, political confusion, changing that there had to be thought a lot of different things, and there was no... For a long time, there was a big deception how it can be changed, things that has to be changed, but there is no possibility. So the other side, what you said is, of course, there were after actions some discussions, had it been done in a good way or in a wrong way. It was an expression of the kidnapping, or the idea to kidnap an airplane was a Palestinian model in that time. They had done it a lot in the beginning of the 70s. And for a short time, it seemed to be a way to succeed to get free prisoners, and it seemed to be something possible for part of us too. But afterwards, the action in the 77 was made. Kian, I don't know the English word, the flight, to get the flight, the airplane.
Like a hijacking?
Yeah, hijacking. Yeah, okay. But this is, were seen afterwards in the people I know as a deep error. The people who made it are all dead. No? But I want to really put clear, the discussion of the dead is a discussion that is really propaganda. Me, nowadays in Germany, by people who don't have a lot of political education, consider me a murderer, that I murdered a lot of people. I murdered no one. But and there were not murdered many normal people. They, if you look who murders normal people and really intends to do that, is fascist people and right-wing people. We tried not to do it, but in some occasions it happened, and it's bad that it happened, but when there is a chauffeur of a very high-rank politician, it's okay. It's something that happened, and it's not... it was not the wish, and you can say, okay, it's very bad, but please consider how it is managed in a propagandistic way, because, as I said, normal people who get to know where I come from say, oh, she is a murderer. I write more about it, about violence and what means violence to me personally too. That it's a very ambiguous thing. But for me, the question is how you can stop injustice with which instruments, in which way you can stop it. And it's something that has to do with time too. Look, we observe now so many deaths. You can observe them too in Canada, wherever. But in Germany, we observe thousands of deaths in the Mediterranean, refugees, how they don't permit refugees to live here in dignity, and there is no question of who murders. I say they are murdered. They don't die casually. No, they are murdered. And who is responsible for that? In this fight, if you want to finish that, you will always... You have to take the responsibility, and you make yourself guilty. Okay, but you are guilty too if you look at it. And for us in that time, it was to finish Vietnam. It was very strong for us to finish what is doing Germany worldwide. And the people who are politically, economically responsible for what is happening in the world, in Germany, they are considered normally as they are civilians, they have they don't look like murderers, but they are murderers because of their responsibility they have in what is happening in the world. And I am guilty when I observe it and do nothing, and I'm guilty when I do something.
Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviera de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside. You're listening to an extended interview with Margaret Schiller, an ex-political prisoner from Germany who spent about 6 years in prison in the 1970s for being part of the armed struggle group the Red Army Faction. Schiller's book, Remembering the Armed Struggle, was just published in English by Montreal publisher Chris Blebedeb. A lot of our listeners are prisoners. The island of Montreal has two prisons on it, and there's a few prisons in the suburbs that get the radio signal too. And especially since the pandemic hit, we've had more and more listeners in prison tuning into the radio. So I'm curious, you talked about a little bit about the kind of isolation that you faced and other RAF prisoners also faced. And, you know, you called it torture, and the descriptions of it in the book are very clear and very intense. And you talk about a difference between experiences you had in that situation where you were conscious of what was happening to you versus experiences where you were not conscious of what was happening, and how that made a big difference in terms of your experience of the isolation. And I'm just curious if you could talk about that difference more, that dynamic more, and what being conscious of it brought for you.
Yeah, that's something very, very important, I think. I later talk to a friend when I lived in Cuba, and she said, yes, do you know the Jewish people who were in concentration camps had very different possibilities to fight, to defend themselves. And the difference was mainly if they had an idea why they were killed, why they were put in concentration camps, or politically, no? Or if they were victims that didn't understand nothing and therefore full of desperation and not understanding why they had put them in camps of concentration, though they had been good citizens. And so this difference is basic to find inside yourself the line to defend against torture, against being destroyed. And I describe in the book that they put me in a dead wing in prison, and I really felt that I have no, I lost my basis, and I felt to come down in parts, and I lost completely my orientation, why I had fought, and what to realize what they were doing. And then I left the dead wing, and after a while I went there, they took me there again. But in the middle I realized what really they wanted with me, that they wanted to make a broken example with me, and that it was no real personal reason why they wanted to destroy me. Now, it was a political reason. I was an example for, and at this they wanted to destroy me. And when I understood that, I found other possibilities to defend myself.
So I think your experience of the dead wing and the specific kinds of torture that you and your political comrades faced in prison seemed a bit different than the experiences of the rest of the prison population at the time. But another way that it seems like your experience was a bit different is the experience of going into prison and having a collective that you are relating to, even though you were scattered across 20 different prisons, having other comrades from that same organization in prison with you. It's not a totally unique experience, but it does seem like something to talk more about.
Yes, of course, to know that you are part of a collective fight is what gives you a lot of strength. And isolation is trying that you lose this knowing. And when you are a long time really isolated, it's with the time very hard to imagine yourself as a part of a collective. I describe a hunger strike. Most of the hunger strikes I made alone. And when I made the first time a hunger strike where I could have really small but contact with others of the collective, I felt it made me a lot stronger. When I was really alone, I saw no one of the others. I couldn't imagine the others anymore. I felt very weak, and it was very hard for me, and partly I couldn't continue fighting. But making it together, not being together at the time, but if you know them near, when you can speak for an hour perhaps together, and all the other time you're alone, oh, you remember again. It's present again that you are not the only one. And that changes completely the conditions of how you can fight.
There have been a lot of hunger strikes in prisons in Canada in the last year, mostly in response to conditions of lockdown as a result of the pandemic. And went on hunger strike many times in prison and experienced something that I don't think has happened to anyone on hunger strike in prison in Canada in the last year, which was force feeding. And so I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about why the government so often reacted to RAF hunger strikes with force feeding, but also a little bit about choosing hunger strikes as a tactic and that decision making.
Forced feeding?
Yeah.
You say it like that, no?
Yeah.
The way the state, German state, thought that they can interrupt the hunger strike with a very brutal torture, physical torture, that they normally don't use. In Germany, physical torture is, especially for political persons, not used exactly, perhaps, but normally not. They would have a lot of problems to justify it in public. But forced feeding is sold as something that is to save our lives. So they do it, and they have no problem to justify it publicly, but it's physical torture. In Germany, in that time, they had to decided to use this way because they didn't find no other way to cut the hunger strike. I think in the 70s, our fight outside and our fight inside the prison was studied very near by counterinsurgency or organizations and institutions. I told you before in respect of our visits, our letters, to see what they can do to have this effect. We were really considered as an example fight, that they started to see how it works with us, with political prisoners, with political fighters, which conditions have sense for them to get the effect they want. Look, isolation system, no, was at that time basically in Germany in a generalized way used. And then from Germany, it started to other countries in Europe. And at the same time, they began to use it in US, but examining it too. It was generalized afterwards, no, in US, in a very terrible way. We looked at it and we said, "Poh, which possibilities do you have as a person who has no political fight before to defend yourself against this system?" We tried, but we were study example for them to see at which point they succeed what they want.
So we talked about how it can make someone feel stronger to be a part of a collective in the prison context. But there's a turning point for you in the book where feeling part of the collective doesn't make you feel stronger anymore, it seemed like. And you talk about needing to distance yourself from the other RAF prisoners and to find your own path. And I wonder if you could talk more about that decision to transfer to a different prison and take space from the group, and what that decision meant to you at the time.
Yes, I saw your question and I laughed. Yeah. I'm not always the same. I don't feel always the same strength. Sometimes I fell down and I think I can't continue. I can't support. I can't live it anymore. I can't continue fighting. I finished. And that happens to, I think, nearly every person in the life. And to me, it had happened several times till now, but I always get up again. And I look at it and say, "How did you get up again?" It's human that I fell down and I can't anymore. I felt with the hunger strikes, I couldn't continue. I didn't feel anymore the strength. And when you, with hunger strike, it's very strong, but it's very different for different persons too. I have seen people who made hunger strikes without no problems. Really, they continued. They really, it didn't cost them so much. And to me, it costed always a lot of strength, a lot of power to continue. And other things for me were easy, and for other people, the same thing that for me is easy in the fight, for others is very, very difficult or impossible. So these kind of differences are normal. And of course, when you feel weak, and when you stop a collective fight, then you feel in a certain way guilty. You feel bad. The fact to stop it, of course, is kind of separation of the collective. And in which way you consider it with the time, it's different of the fight, and it's different of the persons who are inside, and it's different of which way you get afterwards to come together again or not. For me, I had broken hunger strikes twice, I think. And the first time, or three times, I don't remember. When I broke the first time the hunger strike, I really felt very bad. And I knew I breaking the hunger strike makes it more difficult for the others to succeed to the goal. But the other prisoners that were at that time in the same floor like me, the other women, made a step to me and began to speak with me. That was very important for me that they didn't put me out. But what happened? Prison administration at once reacted and took me out and put me again away in another town in a dead wing. That there couldn't happen any solidarity between us again. They wanted not to permit solidarity between us. Okay. For me, then I really understood very well what I had told yet, why they put me in the dead wing, what they wanted to do with me in a situation where I really felt very bad and guilty. But I understood that I could find the way to fight. In 77, after so many years in prison and difficulties, and I felt I need a space to rethink everything. And I think it's always like that. If you have had a very near relationship and you feel that in a certain way you go other direction, you have to make a step beside. It's human. And if it's in a family like that, it's in a group outside like that, it's in, between a husband and a woman, when you see, oh, well, you have to take a step beside. And in prison, when you are on the same floor, you can't. You have to make physical distance. And the only way I could make a physical distance at that time was to say, okay, please, I want to be in another prison. But I think it's the most logical way in hard conditions, when there is really, when you don't live in luxury, and when you live in luxury, surely it will be the same. You have to go beside to have your own thinking and your own mind and rethink everything again.
Another thing that happens while you were in the women's prison in 1978 is that other RAF prisoners come to that prison, and you and other RAF prisoners end up initiating a hunger strike, and a lot of the women in general population participate in the hunger strike. I for me, this was one of my favorite moments in the book. I feel like I've read a lot of a lot about revolutionaries trying to organize in prison, and sometimes it goes well and sometimes it really doesn't. And this was such an interesting moment where you and your comrades were able to explain why you wanted to go on this hunger strike, and the other women felt a sense of solidarity and camaraderie with you all doing the hunger strike together. I'm just curious if you could tell our listeners more about this experience and what it was about. Like, did that hunger strike feel different than the other hunger strikes that you had been on in prison? And if it did, how did it feel different?
Yes, at first, really, it felt very different in respect of what I had said before, in respect of hunger strikes. We were together. That's something different. The fight is very different when you're making something together than when you have to do it alone. And but it was something with the women prisoners that was, I think I describe it in my book too, it was, we took a lot of steps together, getting to know each other and making other things before. We had made other actions before in the interest of the prisoners, and we had created confidence. That is the main basis to be able to do something together, no? So really there were partly, of course, the population in prison is like outside. There are bad and there are very strong and persons with whom it's a pleasure to fight together. Have to have the possibility to make different levels of fights together to show that it's a pleasure to fight. I think it's very important to be able to show that and to make feel that it's a pleasure to fight. For me, saying it nowadays in my age, I say I love to fight. Oh, for a long time I couldn't say that, but it's that's where you find the strength and the possibility to convince others to and yourself to make it. And the hunger strike we made together was not without end. To make a hunger strike and you don't know when it ends is for me something that was very, very hard. And because my experience always was that in the way it's taking time, you lose the contact, you lose the possibility to communicate, the isolation is more and more. And in a normal prison, they can't. Institution can't isolate yourself in this way, except one or two in downstairs, no? How do you say, killer? I don't know. It's really downstairs where there is no light, where there's no natural light. Yeah, I think it's the basement. Yeah, there are always three cellars where they can isolate people, no? Mm-hmm. But not 20, not 30. And so they couldn't isolate us. We were together. We could speak because it was an old building. Very important in that is when it's an old building, they can't cut really the communication. They can't. And there was the will, the wish of everyone who took part in the hunger strike and in the fights before to communicate and to see each other and or to hear each other and another space of having the possibility to live solidarity. Very different to what I spoke in the beginning, when you live in different jails, when you live very with a big difference, physical difference, one to the other, and you can't communicate, and everyone is isolated inside every jail too. So there your personal capacity to to give solidarity is getting minor and minor, because you have to put all your strengths to survive.
So not that long after that hunger strike, you were released from prison, and that was the second time that you are released and you have to deal with the after effects of isolation and of the violence of prison itself once you are released. And a lot of our listeners would be doing time in federal prisons, which in Canada means they are sentenced to more than 2 years in prison, and a lot of them will spend, you know, a lot of time, a lot more than 2 years in prison. And I'm just curious if you have advice for people who are newly released from prison and what kind of strategies you found for dealing with the effects of isolation and of having been in prison for so many years yourself.
Yes, look, you are the first person who asked me that. So I You wrote me the question before, but I thought, oh yes, that is something I never discussed. I can, of course, say something more general, because I think a very important thing in treating traumatized people or how do you say, injuries, being psychological injuries, it's always very important to treat the body, to try to feel, to understand what you feel, and look for a possibility to open that. Look, for me, all my life, it was very important, water. I love to swim, and I love to enter in a sea, or if I don't have a sea, I go to a swimming pool. That's not the best, but every person has something that gives her or him energy. And of course, prison is cutting everything. If you didn't know before you got in prison, what gives you energy, try to find it out. Or if you know it yet, from the time before prison, try to refer to that. Because words, of course, they can help, but words are words. And what we lived in prison is much more than you can treat with words, because all the body, all the soul, everything was affected. And how you can go return in some way to your own strength. And the elements, mountain, I don't love mountains, nothing, but I know people who love mountains. I love, as I said, yet water, but whatever. There are different elements, and I love music. Music for me is very important, to dance. It's absolutely important to find myself, to find my strength. And whenever I can do it, and I think I can't, but I can, I have to dance. So refer to these kinds of basic elements that can give you a strength without that are interfering people with their words. Of course, it's very important and very good to have friends, or perhaps to make a therapy. I personally don't want to do that, but it's I have political reasons for that. But there are a lot of different possibilities. But look what you need, what you really need, what you feel that you need, where you get strength.
That does make me realize that I would be into it if you explained a little bit about the other political group that you were affiliated with before you went to prison, which was the Socialist Patients Collective, or the SPK, for people who've never heard of it before.
Yes, for me personally, it was very, very important. The anti-psychiatric group was historical in that time too. There, in different countries, there were groups like that. Not to stay with traditional therapy with psychopharmaca, you understand? Psychopharmaca, mm-hmm. with medicine that is chemical. When you feel you have a problem, for me, I felt that I had big problems with my parents, especially with my father, and I I didn't know how to manage that. And I felt very inhibited for that. And so I went to this group. And there I learned that a lot of personal problems and personal problems are problems that a lot of people have because they have social reasons. And that was something that liberated me in a very strong way to see, oh, it's not my fault that I feel in that way and that I can't carry that. No, many people around me feel the same. So it's really not a personal thing. And we have to go to the reasons and we have to understand where it does come from. That was for me very, very important. To get out of this isolation in my personal problems. And we tried to treat these things as collective too. That means there was in the group not one doctor, one psychologist that was the authority. No, we tried to teach each other how to manage certain problems and to speak in a group. At that time, it was revolutionary. Nowadays, psychologists make groups where they speak together. But at that time, it wasn't like that. It was all individualized. And we made groups without a doctor, without a psychologist. No, we tried to understand together as a group what is the problem, where it comes from, and how to manage it. I was there not a long time because police closed it, but it was very strong that put me in the way to don't analyze myself only as an individual, but to understand me as part of society and part of my problems, or a lot of my problems were produced by social conditions and social hierarchies and so on.
You're listening to a pre-recorded episode of the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. The station is currently closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic, but we're still trying to air as much original content as possible. That was an interview with Margaret Schiller, an ex-political prisoner and former member of the Red Army faction, an armed struggle group that was active in Germany between 1970 and 1998. Schiller was involved in the group between 1971 and 1977, although the vast majority of that time she was in prison. She has released a book about her time in the Red Army faction, which is called Remembering the Armed Struggle. And once again, you can find that book, which is recently translated into English by Montreal publisher Chris Blabadeb, and that is online at leftwingbooks.net. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Prison Radio Show. We also have a podcast, so you can find us on any podcasting apps. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday of the month at 11 a.m. Our next show will air on Friday, April 23rd at 11 a.m. If you have any questions about anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us. Our email address is prison@ckut.ca, and our phone numbers were listed earlier in the show. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. If you're in prison, we encourage you to contact us in any way possible. You can write to us. We have a mailing address. It is The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you so much for tuning in to The Prison Radio Show. We hope you have a great rest of your night. Thank you.
soon for Upstage.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah Day, recording from home on March 4th, 2021. On tonight's show, my guests. Performer and creator Véronique Raymond on the science of theater.
I love science. My dad is a chemist. Science is part of my life. And I strongly believe in the fact that we need more data around theater to better explain how it contributes to our collective well-being and to the progress in our society.
Mara Tier, a graduating student at the National Theatre School, on new show, Everybody.
As this year's progressed and I've seen that how resilient the art world is to any challenge, I'm like, I'll be totally fine. And me and my classmates are going to be really okay, because I have done a self-tape where I just got like a table, I stacked a stool in it and a bunch of books, and I propped my phone up and pointed a lamp, and I was able to make a self-tape. So it was like, I don't know. I